have with the impact and exactly what's happening. Because the gospel writers, being inspired, don't really write the way that you and I would. You have to turn that down quite a bit back there if you can. We left off with the trial of Pilate when he is in front of Pilate, and it is referred to in 1 Timothy 6 and 13, and we're said that he had made the great confession in front of Pilate. And of course, that great confession then is that he is the king, and that's why he was born. That's the reason he came into this world. And then he tells Pilate then that he came to bear witness of the truth, and everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Pilate's not interested in that. He's not interested in those kind of discussions, philosophical. He's the Roman governor. He's not really a governor, but he's a military dictator. So he kind of loses interest there, but it is what he suspects, and that is for envy. They have delivered this man up, and then he doesn't see any crime in him. He doesn't see any guilt in him. And so then he goes back out and begins to talk to these Jews again once more, declaring his innocence, saying that he hasn't found any crime in him, and then trying to find out if he can reason somewhat with these Jews. He finds out very quickly that they're not interested in that. They're not interested in that at all, and they begin to, of course, they've changed the charges several times. Now we're going to find out several other charges. Right here is where we're going to take a little bit of a leap from John, just because John, he does some really special things for us. He gives us what other gospel writers do not give us. But in some things, very important in these trials, I think, that you'll find interesting, then of course John leaves them all out, leaves it out completely. And so what we'll do here is we're going through John 18. When you get down to about verse 37, 38, you will find that we can tie this in very easily to Luke's gospel. You're going to find that we can tie this in because it is right here where he declares his innocence, and then he goes outside, begins to talk to these Jews, but then they bring up the subject of releasing a prisoner at the Passover. Well, if we tie that in with the other synoptics, then you'll find out that there is a big part here that's missing. That's in Luke 23, 6 through 12. So what we'll do is let's just leap over there real quick and jump into Luke 23, and then we'll start from about verse 6 or so. And this is right here where now Pilate hears that he's a Galilean. We've already said that Pilate is determined himself that this man is innocent of the charges. But he also sees how this crowd is going, much like you and I would see if you've ever seen a mob. It's not known for its cogent abilities. It's not known for rationality. You could ask when you go through the streets and interview somebody, say, in this mob action, you'll find so many different answers as to why they're in the streets and all that. It begins to just take a life of its own, and what was a peaceful demonstration may just burn down the whole city or something like that. But it's probably the most frightening thing is to watch people, humankind, in some kind of mob action because you lose all kind of thinking. Pilate understands this, and he's watching this, and so now he begins to get somewhat a little bit desperate. I want you to understand that Pilate here is not squeamish. He's not a politician. He may not have been the best general or a great soldier because he's probably in the position he is because of some kind of nepotism, because of friendships, because of backroom deals. We know that. Why? Because he's not even appointed by Tiberius, is he? It's Sejanus that has appointed Pilate, and so that kind of makes you think as Sejanus is doing all these backdoor deals, and he's trying to take over the empire, he's the one that puts Pilate out there, so it kind of makes you think that maybe there's some collusion going on there. But when Pilate, his background is that of a soldier. You have to understand in these days, when soldiers met in the field of combat, it was not with a drone, it was not very clean, it was not something that you'd have to study some recon photos later to see if you hit the target. That they would just clash with each other, and then they would go wash the blood off of their enemies, off their hands, off their suits of armor, and off of the things that they would do and take care of the bruises and the cuts. When you went into a city most of the time when you were the Roman Empire, and maybe you would be unopposed. That didn't mean you just kind of came in and started doing some really good altruistic work like building hospitals and things. normally you still wanted to instill some kind of fear in the population, and you begin to live off of it like a maggot, so that you would go ahead and take the things that they had, and while doing so, you could imagine all of the insults and the assaults that, and abuse that would happen on the population. That's something very, very typical. And you're going to see that again when the soldiers gather around Jesus and he's alone in the back room with them. That these aren't people that have just been trained at the local police academy and they're back there trying to do some questioning. These are just men that have gone into the debauchery of human existence, of cruelty and the things that make them feel good about somebody else's pain and all of that. Pilate's used to that. So he's not squeamish. He's not trying to get out of something here that, you know, that he couldn't stand. He's going to crucify others, and he's done it before. But he knows, even Pilate knows, that for envy they have delivered this innocent individual up, and he has never seen anyone act like this person, being accused up into this death so that he would see it's coming, and he knows it's coming, and yet he cannot get the demeanor out of Jesus that he sees. And so it just must rattle him. And so now he begins to be desperate. So when he hears that he's a Galilean, he understands now that he's in Herod's jurisdiction. Not that that wasn't Pilate's jurisdiction, but Herod is up there. He's a ruler over the Jews as well. And so he thinks, okay, this is a way I can finally get out from under this burden that these Jews that I hate, I despise them, but they put me in this situation, and now I'm going to be able to get out of this. I'm going to send them up to Herod, let them take care of this business once and for all. And so he sends them over to Herod. Herod is in town in Jerusalem at this time. He would have been up in Tiberias. And then so when he goes there, he begins this trial in front of Herod. Let's just talk about Herod just for a second here. You know, we know that Jesus called him that fox earlier in the gospel accounts. Herod is an individual. His father, of course, is Herod the Great. Herod the Great has many women. So when we say that these are brothers and the Herod and the Agrippas, the way they relate mostly is that they're half-brothers, half-sisters, they're half-nephews, half-cousins. But his mother's Malthace, and Malthace does have a couple of sons by Herod the Great, and his older brother was Archelaus. Now Archelaus, you would remember from the Bible too, is an individual that when Herod the Great dies, you see Herod the Great has killed many people, he's known for being a big builder and for being a bloody man. He kills three of his sons. He kills Alexander, he kills Aristobulus, and then he kills Antipater. He kills all three of those. And the one that survives, and when Herod dies, the one that takes over the kingdom is Archelaus. Now, you'll know it from Matthew chapter 2 and 22 in your Bible. When Joseph comes back down out of Egypt, it says that Joseph finds out that Archelaus is ruling, and then what does it say? He says that he's in fear. And you think, oh, well, he's in fear because the son of Herod the Great is still in power, and maybe he passed on the death sentence to his son. No, that's not it at all. They probably rarely talked. It's not that at all. The Bible writers don't even know what's going to go down in secular history about Archelaus. They're not trying to prove to you one way or the other. They're just telling you what happened, that Joseph came back, he found out Archelaus was in power, and so he was fearful. Why? Because Archelaus was bloodier than his dad. They're not going to tell you that in the gospel accounts, but that's what we know from history. And whichever gospel writer writes that down, he's not trying to think, well, this is what they're going to say in history later on, and we need to make this harmonize. But I will tell you that it's little phrases like that that keep leaping out at you that completely coincide with the rest of history and what we know. And it's just amazing to me. He had that kind of reputation. Joseph knew it, and when he came back down, he was fearful, and so God warns him in a dream. He goes up to Galilee, fulfills the prophecy there. He's in Nazareth, and that's when our story starts. Archelaus doesn't last very long. The Jews, you see, they'd put up with Herod the Great because he was so powerful. When a man takes office and he builds this huge political machine, you can only be a despot as far as the people will allow you. In Argentina or Venezuela or anywhere. But if you overstep that, soon things begin to unravel. And what happened is Herod the Great had everybody in power, and so he was able to chop a few heads. He was able to kill some babies. He was able to get by with those things. But his son coming in thinks, that's what I'm going to do as well. But his political machine is not as strong. Does it kind of remind you of Rehoboam? Rehoboam takes over and he just immediately oversteps his bounds. What did he do? He loses more than half his kingdom. And that's what Archelaus does. He comes in, he tries the same old antics, and the Jews have had enough. They send a delegation out to Caesar, and they said, "This, if you don't get rid of him, then you're going to have an uprising." Caesar has no love in his heart for the Herods at all, so he goes out and he says, "You know what, you're right." And then he deposes Archelaus. That's the full-blooded brother of Herod. But instead of giving the kingdom to Herod, Caesar says what? "You know what, I'm so sick of these Jews and everything that's going on in Palestine." So he gives Herod Antipas, and he says, "You go up to Galilee and Perea. You hang out up there. You're going to be the tetrarch up there." But for the first time, the Jews in Palestine then get a governor. And he comes in about 6 AD. So that's also why when you're reading your Bible, the only power really in the land when Jesus is born was Herod the Great, even though they were under Roman rule. But the Romans don't send out a governor until later on, until Jesus is a small boy. Now that's Herod's, his full-blooded brother. So now he is up here, and he builds a city up in Lake Gennesaret, or in the Galilean Sea there, and that city is called Tiberias. You all have heard of it. You'll read about that in the Bible. But that's something that he built. He named it after the Caesar that's in power, which is Tiberius. So he's a great builder himself, and he has a run-in with John the Baptist. When he has this run-in, John the Baptist, in Mark chapter 6 and verse 15 or so, you'll find out, this is very interesting, that he takes John the Baptist, he arrests him, but he's afraid of him because of his following. Now, you'll get the idea that there is a pretty big following if you read the gospel accounts. If you read secular history, John the Baptist, no matter if you're Christian or not, and mostly the non-Christian Jew, looked at John the Baptist as an amazing prophet and figure. Which is kind of interesting because he's not healing anybody. He's not healing the blind. He's not walking on water. But he must have been an incredible preacher of righteousness. And so he arrests John the Baptist. He brings him in, and because of Herodias, he ends up beheading him and having him killed. That's when he first hears about Jesus on the scene and what's happening. He's so afraid of the power and the following of Jesus, he thinks it's John the Baptist come back to life. Now, when he beheaded John the Baptist, we're told that it was because of Herodias. But who was Herod first married to? Why did John tell Herod and send word to him that it was unlawful for him to have her? So he took her from his half-brother Philip, who was the most ablest ruler out of all the Herods. You know what his problem was? He's a good guy. You know what happens to good guys in politics? They don't last very long. It's a mark of society that if you're not ruthless enough, you just don't get to the top. And that's what happens to Philip. And he loses his own beautiful wife over it. She goes to live with Herod. And this Antipas now has her unlawfully, but he had been married to Aretas the king's daughter, the Dabedian king. So Aretas is kind of now, he's very offended because his daughter that he's given to Herod has been divorced so that Herod can take Herodias. That's going to come into play later in Herod's life, unfortunately. But now we see that he's beheaded John the Baptist, and now he thinks Jesus has come back to life, and he hears about his miracles, his signs, and his wonders. Later in Herod's life, in 36 AD, he's going to find that Aretas has never forgiven him, and that Aretas has vowed he doesn't want Palestine, he doesn't want to take over the Jews, he doesn't want Judea, he just wants to punish Herod. He has been so affronted by this divorce. So we know that he comes in, he builds up his forces, and he catches Herod out. Herod gets lured into battle, and Aretas destroys his army. Josephus said that the Jews said that the reason his army was destroyed was because of what he had done to John the Baptist, that it was God's divine judgment. Now, I want you to think about several things. When you read somebody like Josephus, the first thing that all the scholars are going to tell you out of Yale and Harvard and Oxford is they're going to say, well, you know, we're not sure if those passages about John the Baptist and Josephus are doctored or not. Well, here's what's interesting. They didn't have to stick anything in there about this battle because we don't read about it in the Bible at all. And what they said was, The reason John the Baptist was beheaded, it had nothing to do with Herodias. What they said in secular history, and Josephus says, is because his following was so great that Herod was envious and afraid of it. Now, that makes a lot of sense, and it may have looked that way to the public eye, right? You really don't know what's going behind the scenes in Washington. You just know what's happening in the public eye, and the same thing for them. So he said, so that's what they wrote. Now, why is that an incredible faith builder for us when they contradict the Bible? Because Josephus, by contradicting the Bible, is not following the biblical account and yet tells you for sure there's a man named John the Baptist who had a great following, who is a preacher of righteousness, that all the Jews thought it was a great prophet, and Herod had him killed. Does that sound familiar? And that's a man that does not read the Bible and doesn't believe in Christianity. That to me is incredible. That's what history is saying about John the Baptist. And it ties in with Herod, who is now the individual that has heard of Jesus. He's anxious to see him, and now he finally gets Jesus in front of him. When he does that, of course, he's going to do what he's been wanting to do, and that is he wants to see something out of Jesus. So he gets taken to Herod, and here is his chance. He knows what Herod's been saying about him. He knows that Herod is anxious to see him. He knows that he's going to the cross. He knows that Herod is going to declare him innocent. He knows all of these things. So you know what? Now's a perfect time why he should just do a miracle or a sign, make a great defense, and let Herod know, you know what? No, I am the king. But he doesn't say that at all. He's completely silent. That's amazing. And so the officers that are around Herod that have followed Jesus into this court now are vehemently, that means, you know, violently with anger and all this emotion, accusing him. And then it says they set him at naught. We don't really speak that way anymore, and we say, well, we set him at naught. Maybe to me it sounds like I'll put you out in the aisle, set you at naught. Now, that's not what that means. It means I despise you. I put you in a despicable place in my vision and in my mind. You are the lowest of the low. I set you at naught, and so therefore I mock you. And that's what happened. And they begin to hit him and spit on him and beat him, and then they mock him. Why didn't he do a miracle? I've asked several individuals before, well, if you believe in him, you think you can do him, just show me a miracle. They've gone back to Matthew chapter 12 and said, oh, but an evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign. There's no sign given it, but Jonah the prophet. Oh, wait a minute. That's way out of context. The individuals that asked for a sign in Matthew 12 and did not receive it, like here at Herod, they had already seen an incredible miracle that they could not deny. All they said is, well, it's from the power of Beelzebub. But we've seen the miracle, we've seen the sign, we can't deny the power, and then they're just perplexed and they can't come up with anything. So they said, no, we'll see a sign from you. We've seen these great miracles, we've seen these things, but we want to see the sign that you're really the Messiah. Jesus, knowing the hardness and the callousness of the heart, says, nope, you're not going to get one, but you're going to get one. You're going to see me come out of the grave. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. When you see that happen, there'll be no more argument. That's why when people say, hey, you're an evil and adulterous generation seeking after a sign, that is totally taken out of context of Matthew 12 and what was happening. Sir? Absolutely. I think you could be right. I have thought, because of who these people were, much like the Pharisees and the Sadducees, miracles did not change their mind. Herod is not a truth seeker. The comment, by the way, is Jesus knows what's coming. He knows he's going to the cross. He's supposed to. He's going to fulfill all prophecy and the purpose of his coming. So why do a miracle and possibly reverse that? That could be true. However, you got to remember the individuals that are here. Those that are accusing Jesus, that are standing there vehemently accusing him, have they seen a sign and a miracle? They absolutely have. Now, Herod may not have, but Herod's not a truth seeker. He's not interested in that. So you take somebody like that, and he's in the same cut as everyone else. And so I believe, personally, had Jesus performed a miracle, he's just showing the weakness of the flesh of saying, yeah, I just want to prove to you that I am right. I just want to show people. I can't take this accusation thing, which is, to me, it's just the most amazing part of the entire process of how he takes this right up until we find out the spikes are being driven into his arms, and then he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Unbelievable. Not even acting like anything we could even imagine. Anyway, good comment. It could very well be true, because he is there to fulfill prophecy, not get out of it. And he's not going to do anything to reverse that. So here's Herod Antipas looking for these miracles. Not going to get any. Jesus isn't going to give him any. And then he sends him back to Pilate. So we pick up the reading again. We could probably pick it up in 19 and probably 39 or so. And this is where we can tie it in and know that he's come back from Herod's at this point. Interesting enough, if we would have kept reading in Luke 23, I want to make this note to you. John doesn't say it because he doesn't mention Herod. He thinks he's just a non-player. But Luke's mentioning Herod, and he says at the very end there, in about verse 14 or 15, he says he sends him back, and Pilate says to the individuals that he's talking to, he says, Herod didn't find any fault in him. That's why he sent him back. And how did he send him back? He was dressed in gorgeous apparel. I want you to remember that, because when we get up to a controversy about whether we wore purple or scarlet, it sure makes it a lot easier if you read all of the accounts of the gospel, read your Bible. We don't have to go to articles. We don't have to go through extensive studies of why it may have been purple or scarlet or anything else. He had ample opportunity to have both on him, and we'll talk about that in a second if we get a chance. He sends him back in gorgeous apparel, goes back to Pilate. Pilate realizes Herod doesn't find any guilt in him. And there at the end of John 19 and 36, I said 19, didn't I? I want 18. Y'all are going to have, how long is it going to take him to figure that he's off a chapter? Now we find in 39, he says, but you have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover, which you therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews. This is another reason I believe this is happening before the Passover, because of this very custom right here, to release and guilt-free an individual before the Passover, not during the feast, sometime after the Passover. And so now he begins to argue with the Jews here, and they're talking about crying out, and they say that not this man, but Barabbas, in verse 40. Now, John says something interesting. He says Barabbas was a robber. Well, is that what Barabbas is? He certainly is, because that's where, that's what John says he is. Barabbas is a robber. But if you go over to Mark 15 and 7, what does it say about Barabbas? Barabbas was, we hear this sometimes, well, he was a murderer, and he was in for insurrection. No, he was a ringleader of the insurrectionist. He was a ringleader of those who had committed murder. But if you're going to lead an insurrection, you are going to be a thief. Because you would go into a small village, and then there you would ask that the young man be enrolled in your cause, because the Roman government is pretty powerful, and you need all of the available bodies and the young men that you can get. If you refuse me, I'll take what I want from your house anyway. You may go by, and you may be asking just for food and water and things like that. You see, there's only so many roles in life you can play. And an insurrection like David was not an insurrectionist, but was he a hunter-gatherer? No. Was he a planter? Was he planting things? No. He was on the run with his mighty men. Where do you think he got his food and his water? From sympathetic souls. And when they weren't sympathetic, where did he go? He went outside of Judea and he took it. David was a raider. And we know that, and that was very common. So he's living off the land, and an insurrectionist is going to go through his own people and be this parasite off of their wealth and off of their food and off of their water, and he's going to take their sons, their daughters, those kind of things. So John's not, he is a thief. But that's not what John's talking about, I don't think. But we know in Mark 15 and 7, we know that Barabbas is this ringleader of numerous individuals that are in prison. He is a murderer. He's an insurrectionist. And they want him to be released. Now, is that ironic to you? You see, he's not just talking about it. He's actually been in the middle of it. Why were they delivering Jesus up? What did they accuse him of? Insurrection. With his words only. What does Barabbas mean? If I said Yehusef bar Caiaphi on the ossuary, it was, hey, this is Joseph, son of Caiaphas. Bar, son of Barnabas, son of exhortation, right? It's a nickname you pick up. How many people know that Barnabas' name was Joseph? It's Joseph that helps Paul. It's Joseph that brings Paul to the apostles. It's Joseph that's an amazing man with a heart and goes out with John Mark and takes a young man that may have been timid and afraid on his first missionary journey and works with him to a point where John Mark is much useful to Paul later on. It was Paul that was wrong. Barnabas is an amazing man, but we don't even know his name is Joseph. Why? Because they called him what he was, and it becomes more popular, and it's more suiting, it's more fitting. And who is Barabbas? Son of, what's Abbas in Aramaic? He's son of the father. I'm going to lead an insurrection over Rome. You're looking for the Messiah. I'm son of the father. I'm going to take over this place. I'm murdering people. I'm taking things. What was he stealing? He was stealing the very identity of Jesus Christ the King. John says, yeah, he was a robber. He was a robber. And they wanted him delivered up. And they said, why don't you just keep this man Jesus? Pilate cannot even figure this out. It doesn't make any sense to him, like it doesn't make any sense to us. I like the way that B.F. Westcott says this. He says they would prefer a licentious, or he uses the word abject, high priest to God's appointed high priest. He said they would have preferred a prophet to the prophet that Moses said would come, or false prophets to the prophet that Moses said would come. They preferred the cruel imperial Roman dictators to God's leadership. It's only fitting, he says, that they prefer an incestuous king to God's anointed and a murderous insurrectionist to the Lord and Savior of mankind, creator of the universe. That says it all. The amazing state of the Jewish state, which is why Jesus pronounced so much judgment on it. And we find that out again and again. So it says in chapter 19 there at the end, or at the beginning of chapter 19, then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. If you take away all the intervening clauses, what's the subject and the object and the verb of it? It's just Pilate scourged him. So we just go on and say, okay, then they put him up, they put these robes on, they put the crown of thorns, they mocked him and all that, and they took him outside and he said, hey, this is... So the three words are Pilate scourged him. You know, unfortunately, I was in this incident we had at one of my organizations. Some sexual misconduct was going on. And I started counseling these individuals. And I couldn't understand sometimes why the females were reacting the way they were with this situation where they, one girl just didn't seem to know right from wrong and had instigated some of these things. And every other facet of her career, she was just amazing airman. So I'm talking to her, and I'm sitting down with her, and I'm just trying to get to the bottom of it, and she finally just bursts out. She looks at me with such a straight, dry face. She just said, "I was raped." Took her about a second and a half to say, maybe less. It's three words. But it brought such torment into her entire life and everything about her. It doesn't matter how long the description is, it's what's behind the description. Pilate had him scourged. It would be a man that stripped naked and put over a post with his arms tied. He's not going to ask one of you to do it. He's going to ask somebody called the executioner, a professional scourger. The reason he's called an executioner is because many people just died right there. So they bend him over the post, and the professional executioner comes up, and he takes this cat of nine tails, and he starts working over the back of the flesh. Work the back of the legs, the buttocks area, and then up underneath the arms and over the shoulders. And what they thought were really fun is that as the individual is sagging there, they can't get to their face on top of their shoulders because their head is just buried down between two arms. So they lash it up underneath into the chest area and hit them in the face. Now remember, these individuals are not saying, "Well, I got to earn a living. There's other things, but I'm just not qualified to do anything else." The reason you're an executioner is because you could sleep real well with it. It's because it's a better job than other things for you. And so they're enjoying this. And once Jesus is in this situation, they put this apparel back on him. Hard to even imagine, really. I guess I put a blank screen here because I tell you, there is no picture. This is why you can't have your cell phone out when the communion's going on. This is why you can't be worried about whether you're making it to lunch or not. This is why we don't come in here and go through some ritual to say, "Well, I missed it this morning, so I'm just going to take it tonight." Because as long as I get a little bit of bread in my mouth and I get a cup to my lips, and I've checked that box off. That's not what this fellowship is about. And when Pilate brings Jesus back out, he is trying his hardest, even as a hardened individual that has bloodlust himself, he is trying his very hardest to show an individual that they would not recognize. And could you only imagine? There's women there. I don't know where these big, strong men were that said, "We're ready to die with you." Possibly John is back at this point. We don't know until the cross, but we do know, where's the rest of this big, strong men? But women are there. And these women, you can imagine looking up through the crowd from the outside and seeing something that you just, whew. You ever walked into a hospital room after somebody, one of your loved ones was in a car wreck and you hadn't seen them in a long time and they've been on a machine, a ventilator and all that, and you walk in and you kind of steady yourself. You're like, man, you think you walked in the wrong, anybody think they walked in the wrong room in a hospital room? He brings him out and he says, "Behold the man." And they're looking at somebody that they can't even recognize. When he says, "Behold the man," I told you last time that Pilate was going to answer a question for us. The question is in John 12 and 34, when they said, "We have read where the Messiah liveth forever. Who is this Son of Man? Who's the Son of Man that you keep talking about that's going to be lifted up? Who is this? We know the Messiah, he lives forever, but who is this Son of Man? And Pilate, unbeknownst to himself, just walks out in this situation, and this just individual that's just a mass of bleeding flesh, and he says, "Behold the man." You want to know who he is? Here he is. And he's looking into their eyes to see if he sees one little glint of compassion. Because he thinks this is better than what they're asking for. Maybe, just maybe, they'll go, okay, all right, we've seen enough. He's got his lesson. But that's not what happens. That's not what happens at all. And they begin to scream out and yell out again. Unbelievable. He's declared his innocence in 1838. He's declared his innocence in 1904. He declares his innocence in 1906. And then they come up with a different charge. He cannot believe. In fact, he says, as he's listening to me, he says, "Take him and crucify him yourself." Does anybody ever read that and just stop and ask themselves, what in the world is going on? Did they have the authority to crucify somebody? And Pilate's going, you know what? You are so distasteful. Take him yourself and crucify him. Kind of like, I've never seen the bloodlust in a crowd that I see now. Take him yourself. He just wants out of it. He just wants away from it. And they scream out and yell out, "No, we have a law. And by that law, he ought to die. Because he made himself the Son of God." Wait a minute. I thought he was a rabble rouser. Wait a minute. I thought he stirred up sedition. Wait a minute. I thought he called himself a king. Wait a minute, I thought he didn't want you to give tribute to Caesar. Wait a minute. What? Oh, now we're down to the roots of it. Now we're where we need to be with the Jewish leadership. He made himself out to be the Son of God, and we have a law. He ought to die because he made himself the Son of God. It says Pilate was the more afraid and went in and questioned him. Now, why was Pilate afraid? You think he's just done all this. Why would he be afraid at this point? Some people think Pilate at this point goes, you know what, that's your law, that has something to do with theology, I don't care, and all. Hold on. What is his religion? See, he's a pagan. He's an idolater. What are the Caesars in Rome? Are they related to God? Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Does he believe that God could come in the flesh in certain individuals? Oh, yes, he does. Now he's worried. That's why he goes back in. He's the more afraid because when he hears that, he's thinking, oh, hold on. I thought this was about insurrection. I didn't know this was about something like that. And so he begins to question Jesus. It's interesting now, I'm trying to find my little cursor here. I might have to just forego my notes. I think I lost it. Anyway, it's interesting at this point when he takes him and he begins to question him. And when Jesus said nothing, Pilate gets so rattled. You could feel the frustration. You could feel this, okay, hold on. You don't even speak to me? Look at you. I have the power to release you. I have the power to crucify you. Are you listening? You don't speak to me? Enough of these games. Give me something. And then Jesus gives him something. You wouldn't have any power over me except to be given from above. Those that delivered me to you have greater sin. Take me outside the city gates and stone me right now. Hear me. Sin separates you from God. Any sin. If you don't think any sin can separate you from God, you don't understand. You don't understand God. No clue. Sin separates us from God. And the wages of sin in Romans 6:23 is what? Death. Period. But somebody has greater guilt. Somebody has greater sin. You go, oh no. Oh no. Matthew 10 and 15, verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable than for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment. How's it more tolerable for somebody in the day of judgment? Because it's about responsibility. And we say, well, you know what? I just don't understand. Everybody get the same thing. And if you're just not a Christian, you do this, that. We have no clue what we're talking about. The only thing we know is what the Bible says. There are going to be those that have not obeyed the gospel, and they will be in torment where the fire is not quenched, and the worm dieth not, period. But it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. He's talking to who? Chorazin and Bethsaida, Matthew 11 and 22. Matthew 11 and 24, same thing. Same thing. He tells Pilate, there are those that have more guilt than you do. I lost my cursor. I had some other things there, but so much for slides. So now, as they begin to cry out, he goes back out to them. And when he does this, he's going to find out that they're not going to be reasoned with. One thing that John does not tell you at this point, well, we'll get to that, but in the early part of John there, in John 19 and 5, he comes out and says, behold the man, and he answers it. He says, crucify him yourself, in verse 6. And then in verse 7, of course, they tell him, this is what it's really about. When he brings him back out in 19 and 12, the Jews are crying out, if you release this man, thou art not Caesar's friend. Everyone that maketh himself a king speaketh against Caesar. Is that a charge? Or is it a political power play? They're expounding as the district attorney and trying to make him understand more what the ramifications of the charges are. It's not really a new charge. It's just they're failing up to this point with everything they've tried. And so now they're going to try this political power play and say, what they're saying is, we know you're really not in with Caesar. He's already watching you because of what we discussed before. He really doesn't trust you. You are in a precarious position with Tiberius, and anyone that makes himself out a king, not a friend of Caesar. And so they are making this political power play. Thou art not Caesar's friend is what they're accusing him of, because this man speaketh against Caesar. So then Pilate therefore heard these words. He brings Jesus out, sat down in the judgment seat, place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. It's a mosaic that sits under the bema. The bema is the judgment seat. It's an official platform where he will sit, and all this mosaic is underneath him. John tells us in verse 14, now it was the preparation of the Passover, it was about the sixth hour, and he said unto the Jews, behold your king. As Bob had told me last week as we were discussing this, or the week before, that Pilate makes this grand declaration again. You see, Pilate's been much more in harmony with the truth than the Jews have up until this point. And he says this again right here, unbeknownst to himself. He says, behold your king. And they come out with this statement. We have no king but Caesar. Crucify him, crucify him. We have no king but Caesar. And with that, the Jews abdicate every position they have to be under the Messiah's salvation. Thanks a lot for your kind attention.